boys and girls, that's the way I run my life, and sometimes people don't understand or get confused. But logic is the only way to run your life, or run your race, or anything else. So many times I say things and dig up things and put things out that people say, well, I don't agree with that. How did he come up with that? You know, whether you're right wing, left wing, or what. Well, simply logic. And if it doesn't fit logic, I don't want anything to do with it. That's why I don't want anything to do with religious fanatics and people like that. People who are trying to spread and sell stuff that just isn't true. It's not logical. Anybody that's a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew, if they use logic, they're going to leave that stuff. Logic's the only church you need. Hey, Tommy, don't be so serious all of a sudden, right at the beginning of the show. Jesus Christ. Oh, wow. Hey, it is the 10th of April, one day after my birthday. My kids came up to see me and took me to the movies. That movie that's running in the theaters where three old guys get pissed off at the bank, the way the bank's foreclosing on their house and stuff. And they say, well, we can do that. And they go out and rob banks. Or at least they robbed one bank. It was a good, very good movie. That's exactly the kind of movie that I need to see. Or maybe not see. I don't know. You know, I'm getting up there to where, well, what the hell have I got to lose? But what would I do if I had $1 million or 500,000? I mean, how important is money in your life? I mean, as long as you got a place to live and you got food on the table and you got friends, you don't need all that stuff. That's why these psychopaths are so unhappy in Washington. These guys are not happy. The way they fought and strived and maybe killed to get where they're at, thinking they'll be happy. They're the most unhappy people in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I think a guy living in an old shack or an old trailer down on the creek or down on the lake could be much more happy than those guys. These guys in Washington, in that eternal rat race, the chase for power and money, they've got to be unhappy. That's why they're always looking around for new chicks and stuff like that. Hey, I see that, what's that guy's name? It's on Fox TV. The big shot conservative. I see he's getting sued again. He got sued once, and the company lost $9 million. Then he got sued twice, and the company lost $20 million. And now there's another gal going to sue him. What the hell's the story? Why don't they fire that son of a bitch? I don't know. Maybe he's got enough on the Fox network to, you know, exert agreements out of them that normally they wouldn't do. I forgot the word I was going to use there. Yeah, Bill O'Reilly. He's such a pompous bastard. Yeah, very pompous. And I doubt whether too many of those women, those hot women with Fox, would really want to lay down with Bill O'Reilly unless it helped their career or something. So far it's cost Fox $29 million, and now it's going to cost them some more, looks like. And anyhow, how can anybody go for $9 or $20 million just because the guy pinched their ass? I mean, that too is ridiculous. That is very ridiculous. I think most of these lawsuits are based upon the fact, not so much physical sex, but he's maybe had sex with them and then promised them a better job and more money and all that, and he didn't come through. That's the typical way they do it. Hey, I watched a good movie last night. about Jake LaMotta, the boxer, middleweight champion of the world. I've always liked the actor that played his part. It was very good movies. I forget The Bronx Bull is called. I think it was a damn good movie about how you stick to it and strive and struggle and take whatever they throw at you and still make it. He was a little woman hungry, though. He's married 5 times. Can you imagine being married 5 times? Difficult for me to imagine. I think my stepfather was married 3 times, and I think he was a little nuts.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Now we stop saying, what's that sound? Everybody, what's going down? What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street singing songs and they carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There are lawyer strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. You better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. You better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. You better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. You better stop. What's that sound?
Most people are always wrong when it's most important to be right. And every time you get an international situation like with Syria and Assad, they're usually wrong. And, of course, most Americans line up with the establishment. They say they don't like the establishment. They even hate the establishment. But when something like happened over there, or maybe happened over there, they line up right fast. Get him, get Assad, get Assad. You know, Assad never did a goddamn thing to me. He didn't change my life at all. So why am I upset with Assad? I'm not upset with Assad. That's his country, and the people need to deal with him or not deal with him. That's the way it goes, you know. How about King Moon Jam Jam Jim Jum Jam over there in North Korea? He never did a goddamn thing to me, and he's not about to drop an atomic bomb all the way from North Korea over here. It's ridiculous. I don't have a quarrel with people who don't have a quarrel with me. My enemies are in Washington, D.C., Wall Street, military-industrial complex, the Pentagon. Those are the people that I have a problem with. In fact, that's about all I have a problem with. Yeah, they say that Assad did this and Assad did that, and all these other leaders do all this stuff. You don't know what they've done. the press in this country is a goddamn bunch of liars all the time. So if they did tell the truth, you wouldn't know it. So they just want regime change. It's very simple. They wanted regime change in all the countries in the Middle East. And that's what it's all about. They don't care nothing about anything else. Causes they come up with are ridiculous. The United States Air Force has killed more people than Assad, or at least almost as many. In Mosul, they've killed thousands of people, destroyed all their houses, made it so they couldn't get out or had a hard time getting out. So who's your enemy? They do it to you. You know, if we had a civil war like the civil war we had before start up right now, those guys at the Pentagon would be bombing the shit out of you if you were on the side that was opposing. If you were a guerrilla fighter or anything like that, they would be blowing your houses to shit. These people are pathological liars and killers, and they don't care. But you think, oh, they're only doing it to those goddamn ragheads. Yeah, baloney. They'll do it to anybody that gets in their way. I mean, even a little bit. Remember that. Pass it around.
Created and potentially could have had drastic and dramatic effects on our country. When we come back, Bill Burns joins me to talk about his findings. Stay with us, Aaron Cousins, a New York Times best-selling author, a magazine publisher, a literary publishing agent, but you probably know him best as one of the co-hosts of the what was a hit series, UFO Hunters, on television. He's got a new companion book out, a companion to the TV series, UFO Hunters, that we can touch on later. But the main subject tonight is his new book, Dr. Feelgood, the shocking story of a doctor who may have changed history, this miracle concoction that he gave to JFK and Marilyn and Elvis and a lot of others. Bill, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, George. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
You know, this stuff is pretty shocking. I read it today. I mean, it's a great book. It's really scary surprising. I think when people hear this, the allegations that you make in the book, they're going to agree. So I think it's important for us to start with the investigation. What evidence you collected to support this?
One of the things that we did, the book actually began with, it was going to be a biography of the actor Robert Cummings, because he had this precipitous fall from being an A-list movie actor in the 1940s. He was one of Alfred Hitchcock's favorite actors. And he had a hit television show in the 1950s, Love That Bob, and he made appearances in Love American Style and The Twilight Zone. He's really well known. But his life took this precipitous fall during his career, and what we found out was that he was a patient of this doctor, Max Jacobson, since probably the early 1950s when he was in New York doing a Playhouse 90, and it was that injection, those series of injections, and sometimes he was getting them twice a week, three times a week. He'd fly back and forth to New York. They were methamphetamines, 30 to 40% methamphetamines. And the thing about meth is that it is addictive. It's chemically habit-forming, but it also turns you into a bipolar individual. You're manic when you're high. You are clinically depressed. You can't function. And the problem with Cummings was he became clinically depressed. He couldn't function. He became psychotic. And they fired him from the television show My Living Doll. We interviewed the beautiful Julie Newmar, who was his co-star on that show. And she told us this story of how he got fired from that show. That was his last entertainment, his serious television entertainment job. And in studying his life, we found out about all the other people around him in show business, Eddie Fisher, Marilyn Monroe, Cecil B. DeMille, even Charlton Heston, people like that who found themselves getting addicted to meth. And this was the same doctor we knew who treated Jack Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy for migraines and fatigue and Jack Kennedy for very severe back pain. And realized this guy had changed history, and it's the story of how a drug infected him, because he was his own addict, infected him and then infected American politicians. Harry Truman, Richard Nixon wanted to go on these drugs, and Jack Kennedy, and how Kennedy's actions as president, his taking drugs, his taking LSD, he's slipping away from his Secret Service detail to have relationships with women in New York, a psychotic break at the Carlyle Hotel where he was running around naked with the press downstairs in the lobby. All this was happening under the watchful eye of the CIA, who knew that it was drugs that impaired Kennedy's performance at the Vienna summit with Khrushchev in 1961, which brought us to the absolute brink of World War III.
Well, I ask the question because those who worship Kennedy, and there's still a lot of Americans who do, and most Americans feel positive about Kennedy and his presidency in that era, a lot of folks are going to have trouble believing this. That's why I was asking about how you put this thing together. You talked to a lot of people. You got FOIA documents, right?
Oh, yeah. We went into Kennedy's medical records. They're available. We had Max Jacobson's own memoirs. They're available. They're in a library in on Long Island, New York. We spoke to people who were with Kennedy. For example, this one person, Mike Samick, Congressional Medal of Honor winner. He was a glider pilot during World War II. He was a refugee from Germany at the start of the Holocaust in the 1930s. He would fly the doctor back and forth. He was a pilot. He'd fly the doctor back and forth to the White House, to Washington, from New York on a regular basis to treat Kennedy. He was there when Max Jacobson treated Kennedy at the Carlyle Hotel and basically caused Kennedy to have this psychotic break. He flew Max to Florida to treat Jackie at the Winter White House. So we interviewed eyewitnesses, and we read Kennedy's medical records, which are eye-opening to be sure, and also saw the memos from the FBI about Bobby Kennedy's interest in what his brother was taking.
Let's start with who Dr. Max Jacobson is. Give me the thumbnail bio.
Max Jacobson was an internal medicine specialist. He was an MD, got his MD in Germany, University of Berlin. And he was experimenting early on with things like the cells of eels, the glands from sheep and pigs. What he was trying to figure out was how blood serum can cure a lot of disorders, like multiple sclerosis. And he developed an injection that was so powerful it made people sick. So what he did to make them feel good, hence the name, was he added methamphetamines, his own formula of methamphetamines that basically became the basic formula for that the Nazis used in World War II and the British and the Americans used in World War II, as well as the Japanese. So he developed this methamphetamine formula. He fled to the United States from Paris in the late 1930s, early 1940s, before the war broke out. And by the middle 1940s, he'd established a practice in New York dealing with a lot of people that he met from Paris, like the film director Billy Wilder, and became a doctor to the show business community in New York, injecting them with meth. And his reputation grew. One of his patients was Chuck Spaulding, who was Jack Kennedy's roommate at Harvard. And it was Chuck Spaulding who, in the fall of 1960, brought Kennedy to Max Jacobson because Kennedy was so weak. He was suffering from fatigue, from back pain. His voice was gone. And it was Jacobson who really got Kennedy back up on his feet and I think was instrumental in Kennedy's performance in the first debate with Richard Nixon. And that, as you know, that swung the polls. Nixon was ahead going into that first debate. After that first debate, Kennedy was ahead and never lost his lead. So Jacobson really changed history in the 1960 election.
Well, we'll focus on JFK and that whole connection a little bit later. Staying on Max Jacobson now, in those days, in the 40s, when he established this practice, meth was legal, right, at least in some forms?
Oh, absolutely. Meth was not only legal. Meth was being used by the United States government during the war to keep pilots awake. So meth was a very, very legal drug. In fact, we have versions of amphetamines today that are still legal. They are in drugs for attention deficit disorder drugs like Ritalin and Adderall. They contain some of the same materials in Max Jacobson's injections.
Did Jacobson tell people what was in it? I mean, I get the general impression from the book, the specific impression from the book, that he would make stuff up. He'd tell them different things that were in it, but never tell them about meth.
That's true. He never told them about meth. In fact, the only way Kennedy found out that it was meth was that Bobby Kennedy took some of the vials of medicine, took them to the FBI, had them analyzed, and that's when he got the formula. Jacobson called them his special vitamin shots, never talked about methamphetamines.
I was struck by the descriptions, the vivid descriptions of his waiting room, that at any given moment when you'd go in there, you'd have an amazing collection of people.
Right. He would have these salon parties, these literary parties with show business people and writers like Tennessee Williams and Truman Capote. They would start after midnight, and they'd run to really to 4 and 5 in the morning. And if you stayed for those parties, your party favor was a high-potency shot of methamphetamines, and you would leave that party flying. And some of the things that people wrote about those parties were incredible.
Some of these folks had to know eventually, hey, this is something more than vitamins.
Well, one of the stories was that Rod Serling and Bob Cummings, the famous writer Rod Serling, who was one of Max Jacobson's patients, this great story of when Rod Serling was, when Bob Cummings was on the Twilight Zone. This was in the 1960s. And he's having dinner with Rod Serling. And Rod Serling is having this thick steak smothered with onions. He's chain smoking cigarettes. And Bob Cummings just lays out, because he was a health food nut. In fact, he had a bestseller in the 50s about vitamins and your health. So he lays out his little capsules of vitamins on his plate. And Serling is looking at him and saying, that's your dinner? And Cummings says to Serling, look at you. You're smoking. You're eating that steak. You'll die before you're 50. I.e., Rod Serling died when he was 50. You'll die before you're 50. And Serling says to Cummings, look, we both go to the same doctor. You know what kind of stuff he's injecting in us. So don't tell me about health. So they
You think that Rod Serling's productivity was directly related to these shots he was getting?
Oh, yeah. Rod Serling was working almost 24 hours a day. I mean, when the chance came for him to do Twilight Zone, and he had to convince the network that a show like that, doing those kinds of stories, would work, he had to be a phenomenal producer of continuity, of writing. And it was methamphetamines that really kept him at that furious pace of turning out these shows every single week.
All these people you interviewed, they've told you what the feeling was like when they got these injections. Describe it.
Well, I think the best kind of description came from the singer Eddie Fisher, Princess Leia's father, right? Eddie Fisher, big singer in the 1950s. Phenomenal story about him and meth as well. But Eddie Fisher said that as you began to decline, as you began to get fatigued, when you got a shot of meth, he said it was like you didn't walk out of Max Jacobson's office, you flew out of Max Jacobson's office. It was like flying so fast and so high, and you believed you could do anything. Tennessee Williams said he would go straight for 72 hours, just riding straight for 72 hours. He would never even think about sleeping. But when he crashed, it was like falling from the top of a building, and you never, never hit bottom. That's why you needed that second shot. And, in fact, you saw this on a recent Mad Men, last week's Mad Men, that television show with John Hamm about Don Draper in the advertising industry. They actually had a Dr. Feelgood character in the office of Sterling Price, giving injections to all the ad people. And they were doing tap dancing. They were running around the office. They were acting crazy. The other thing it made you was hypersexual. In addition to feeling very grandiose, it's a psychotic reaction, you felt hypersexual. And Eddie Fisher blamed that on his many, many relationships.
And, of course, that becomes a factor for JFK, too, and we'll get to that as well. I asked the question about the waiting room because you described it as, at any given moment, the amazing array of talent and stars, writers, actors that would be sitting there waiting to see Dr. Feelgood.
That's right. You would have producers like Alan J. Lerner from My Fair Lady, Tennessee Williams, one of our greatest playwrights, Truman Capote, the guy who wrote In Cold Blood and Breakfast at Tiffany's. They were all in that same room waiting for their shot. Anthony Quinn, the actor Anthony Quinn, sitting in that room waiting for their shot. And this is not some high-end waiting room. You're not looking at someplace really fancy. This was a small, cheap office on New York's East Side. It was the only thing Max Jacobson could afford at the time, even though he had a big research lab out on Long Island. And this collection was probably the single greatest collection of American talent, all talking and having a party and eating and whatever and waiting for their methamphetamine shots.
And all of them on speed.
Every one of them on speed.
You also described Dr. Jacobson as sort of disheveled, he had dirty fingernails. The office itself was kind of a wreck.
Well, that was one of the shocking things about this doctor. He was covered in blood. First of all, he self-injected. And that was why his license was taken away, because he was injecting himself. So all the psychological problems that his patients had were the same ones he had. But he'd walk around the office in a lab coat stained with blood. He had track marks up and down his arms. His fingernails were filthy. And people would look at this guy and say, how can this guy be a doctor? But it was the shots themselves that really turned you into a true believer. In fact, Kennedy's description of seeing Max Jacobson. I mean, here's Jack Kennedy, one of the richest people who ever ran for president, right? His father was very rich. He's looking at Jacobson, and he's saying to himself at first, why am I here? Look at this guy. And he looks at this disheveled individual, and it was only after he received his shot that he realized how important this guy could be to his career. But Jacobson was a mess.
Before we get to the JFK section, Cecil B. DeMille, he became pretty dependent on this, so much so that he flew this doctor around with him.
Well, again, one of the funny stories is that DeMille was so dependent on the shots he was getting from Max Jacobson that in order to complete the movie The Ten Commandments, which he filmed in Egypt, he flew Jacobson out to Egypt to live on the set with him and to attend him every day. And in fact, when he wasn't getting, in that very famous scene when Charlton Heston as Moses receives the Ten Commandments, he wasn't getting the high-powered performance out of Heston. So he said to Max Jacobson, give him a double shot of methamphetamines. And so the intensity of Charlton Heston in that movie, The Ten Commandments, he was on meth at the time he did that scene. He stayed with him in Egypt. Then when the time came to promote the movie, Cecil B. DeMille asked Max and his wife Nina to accompany him on the world tour for the movie. The big thing was going to Rome to convince the Pope to get behind the movie, and Jacobson was there at the Vatican meeting the Pope in England and in Germany as well, so back when he met Konrad Adenauer. So, yeah, he was like a piece of luggage for all these people, but he felt wonderful.
It's amazing to me that he didn't have more money, you know, that he wasn't wealthy as a result of helping so many rich and powerful people.
On the one hand, he didn't really take money. On the other hand, he had a research facility all the way out on Long Island in which he was manufacturing methamphetamines and shipping out vials of these drugs all around the world. So one of the rumors was, and it's a rumor because I don't have his financial records, but one of the rumors was that he was making a lot of money on drug distribution, and the amount of drugs he was shipping, that too was investigated by the New York State Board of Regents that was examining his medical license. And they noted that this guy was shipping more drugs out and manufacturing, it was a manufacturing facility, and manufacturing more methamphetamine drugs than he could have possibly dispensed to all of his patients because they had his patient records. So we think he was making money on the side from drug distribution, but he lost it all during his license revocation hearings.
I'm trying to remember what the figure was in the book, but I thought it was something like they could account for 29 pounds of meth, which is, you know, that's an amazing amount by itself.
Oh, yeah. And there was a lot more. So that was part of the problem. There was a lot of meth going out of his lab, and what they were able to do was, since they knew how he made it, they could see what shipments he was getting in from the raw materials, and then there was this huge discrepancy between the materials he was receiving and the meth he was distributing to patients. There was a big hole, and they couldn't account for that amount of meth.
Something like the equivalent of 100,000 doses a year that he was distributing?
Yeah, easily. Easily.
And that's
the problem.
I guess one of the things we can talk about, I don't know if we can do it now, we got about a minute before the break, but whether or not this is related to the meth outbreak, I mean, it's a terrible scourge. It's a terrible drug.
Well, the answer is yes. The short answer is yes, and we could talk about it when we come back, but yeah, absolutely. He was the poster boy for the drug war, and meth in America today is a direct result of what he did in the 1950s and 60s.
Were there benefits, though, that were documentable for his patients in the short term? I'll tell you what, Bill, the music tells us we got to go to break. And, of course, it might be cheesy, but we got a song from Motley Crue called his new book, Dr. Feelgood, this shocking story of this doctor who cooked up this concoction that what he said was vitamins and minerals, some sort of natural supplements, but actually was speed. And the number of people that he got hooked on this stuff is astonishing. We continue the conversation with Bill Burns right after this on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. My guest is Bill Burns, co-author of Dr. Feelgood. Bill, you mentioned briefly that this drug had been distributed to troops during World War II. I guess the Germans really relied on it quite a bit, and that even it's said in your book that even Hitler and Eva Braun may have been on the stuff as well?
Yes. Hitler's doctor was a guy called Alfred Morell, who basically used Max Jacobson's formula, as did the German government, and he was injecting Hitler, giving him capsules as well, on methamphetamines. And this was throughout the entire war. And he was attending Hitler even in the bunker and up in the Black Forest, up in Hitler's retreat. So, yeah, Hitler was on drugs. In fact, History Channel did a piece on that years ago called High Hitler, about his drug use.
Hey, you think it was Jacobson's own formula, though?
One of the things Jacobson complains about in his memoirs is that in the 1930s, obviously as the Nazis were coming to power, it was the form of a subpoena. They basically made a demand for specimens of his drug, because he was very well known in Berlin, specimens of his drug and the formula. And he had to give them over. The brown shirts paid him a visit. He had to give them over. And when he knew that he was on a list of those who was going to be picked up, that's when he fled to Prague. But he gave that formula to the Germans, and he actually knew which pharmaceutical company manufactured those drugs for the German troops as well as for Hitler himself.
You make the point in the book that this guy, Dr. Jacobson, was a bit of a control freak, you know, that he had plenty of his patients, I guess, who over the years tried to find out what was in that stuff because they were worried, gosh, what would happen if something happens to you or I'm separated from it? I need to get it, right? But he wouldn't give it to him.
No, he wouldn't. And he was indeed a control freak. In fact, that's one of the symptoms. That's one of the psychotic symptoms of methamphetamine addiction. You become obsessive about maintaining control, because what you're afraid of is that the very drug that's keeping you up is you're not going to have it anymore for some reason. So he was a control freak, and that need to control forced him to expand his circle of patients and inject more and more people. There's this fabulous story, didn't make it into the book, that Jacobson was also another patient of his was Sam Giancana, Momo, Sam Giancana, the Chicago organized crime cartel leader. Well, Sam Giancana had a girlfriend who was Phyllis McGuire of the McGuire sisters, and he was injecting Phyllis McGuire. and she wanted to stop. She said, I can't take this anymore. It's making me sick. She was performing on the Ed Sullivan Show. Jacobson shows up backstage at the Sullivan Show and is actually chasing her around backstage at that theater to give her a shot of methamphetamines before she goes on.
There was another woman, I can't remember the name, but a mistress that that JFK shared with Sam Giancana, who also, I think, was getting shots, or I think she's listed in the back of your book.
It's Judith Exner Campbell,
yeah.
The very famous Judith Exner, who was the go-between from Kennedy to Sam Giancana, and one of the things she was going between was she was distributing drugs. When Max Jacobson was visiting Las Vegas with Eddie Fisher, that's when he met Giancana. And supposedly at that table, Giancana was complaining about a headache. It wouldn't go away. He was feeling sick. Max said, you know, I can fix you up. And Giancana said, yeah? And he says, I guarantee it. And Giancana made this threat, you're going to guarantee it with your life if you can't. He gave him one shot, and Giancana became hooked.
This doctor, though, I mentioned him being a control freak. I mean, he enjoyed being able to have some sort of influence over powerful people, being invited to these big shot events that going all over the world, right?
He really did. The fact that he got to go to the Kennedy inauguration, that he met Harry Truman, that he met Lyndon Johnson, for a guy who grew up relatively poor, modestly poor in Berlin, first in a little village called Forda in Poland, and then in Berlin, this was to him the kind of the apex of his career, being with all these powerful people, flying on a private plane, going on Air Force One to Europe with the president. This was the apex for him.
All right, into JFK. You mentioned that a friend of his makes the introduction. JFK, as a senator, goes to this office and he sees, wow, what the heck am I doing here? What's going on? But he had terrible health problems at the time.
JFK was so sick that it is likely, given what we now know about Addison's disease and the other things he had back in the 1950s, given that, it is unlikely he would have made it through his second term in office had he won in 1964. That's how seriously ill Kennedy was. And here is one of the worst things about it. Everybody gets sick. People get better. Some people don't. But Kennedy had his doctor, Janet Travell, and this letter is actually in the book, in the photo section. He had his doctor, Janet Travell, write a letter for distribution to the press that Kennedy was in absolutely perfect health, even though he had Addison's disease, Crohn's disease. He was taking five shots of Novocaine a day. He was on phenobarbital for his back pain and for his irritable bowel syndrome and, of course, the methamphetamines. But he had her write that letter, and it was an absolute, unabashed, unequivocated lie that he was in perfect health and fit to be president. He couldn't even walk when he wasn't on camera. He was usually on crutches. That's how bad he was.
So he gets a shot, and immediately there's a positive reaction.
He walked into Jacobson's office. He could barely stand up. And there was a quick patient-doctor intake session. Jacobson gave him a shot, and within minutes, Kennedy was feeling better. He returns to Jacobson's office right before the first debate with Richard Nixon. He has no voice left. He's rasping. And he basically complains about his all of his symptoms. Jacobson shoots him right in the larynx. And within minutes, his voice comes back. He's full of bounce. He actually almost climbed out of the window. He had so much energy. That's the energy he brought into that first debate with Richard Nixon. He was able to control it, so he didn't seem manic. But the difference between Kennedy and Nixon, you could see those debates that are on the Internet, the difference between Kennedy and Nixon on that first debate made the difference in that election. History changed at that first debate.
So after JFK is elected, he wants Jacobson, he starts inviting him to the White House on a regular basis, right?
Yes, he does. He either comes to New York to get his shots, or he has his friend Mike Samick, who is a World War II hero, to fly him to Washington. The other person who was flying him down was this person, Mark Shaw. This is where it gets interesting. Mark Shaw was this very, very famous high-fashion photographer. Back in the 1950s and 60s, you would see his photographs of Audrey Hepburn. They're famous, and other stars. During World War II, Mark Shaw was OSS. After the war, after 1947, he became an officer in the CIA, a non-official cover officer for the CIA, because he was traveling all around the world seeing movie stars, traveling to places where CIA officers couldn't really go with complete freedom. He was their eyes and ears. And we even have non-official cover officers in the CIA today, and I've met a few on during UFO Hunters. But this person was CIA. Jacobson, according to his FBI file and his CIA records that are available, you can get them under the Freedom of Information Act now, he was treating Soviet agents. So the Soviets, he was turned in Vienna in the 1930s, obviously before there was a KGB or an NKVD, and then in the United States, he was a Soviet operative. And so here's a doctor treating the President of the United States, who's working for the Soviet Union. Whether he renounced communism at some point in his life, we don't really know. He doesn't talk about it in his memoir. But he was tagged as a Soviet agent by the FBI, by J. Edgar Hoover, and the CIA. One of his patients is a CIA cover officer, a non-official cover officer, who's flying him to the White House to meet the president. Mark Shaw was also the official White House family photographer. So the CIA had a man literally in the family quarters of the Kennedy White House. That's how connected everything was.
Kennedy started calling him, I guess, or had staff members calling under a code name, and that meant you got to drop everything. The president needs a shot.
Right. The code name was Mrs. Dunn. Mrs. Dunn is calling. And when he got that phone call, whatever he was doing, this was presidential information. At one point, after Bobby Kennedy made a real ethnic slur about Jacobson because he knew what Jacobson was injecting into his brother, after that moment, Jacobson said to Kennedy, "I quit. I'm not your doctor anymore. Go find somebody else. I'm not going to take this abuse. I fled Germany. I don't need this in the United States." And Kennedy not only implored him to keep injecting him, but he said, "I want you to move into the White House. We're going to give you quarters in the White House. Live there because I want you on hand 24/7 to give me injections." And Jacobson turned him down. He said, "No, I can't leave New York. I've got too many multiple sclerosis patients that I deal with." So literally that was the intensity of their relationship.
And Jackie ended up taking it as well.
Jackie was funny because after the birth of John, and then there was another child that died, it was a miscarriage, Jackie was suffering from phenomenal migraine. She was always camera shy. She always had this issue with appearing in public. And so what would happen is that right after the inauguration, Jacobson got an emergency message that he had to fly down to Palm Beach, which is where Kennedy had the winter White House. He didn't. That's where he met Jackie officially for the first time. She was suffering from a migraine. She could barely move. He gave her a shot, and she, too, became a patient. And, in fact, one of the funny things about this is remember two moments. One moment was the very famous Jackie Kennedy tour of the White House, where she seemed – If you see that again, she seems not drunk, but her speech is slurring. She seems almost a little bit ditzy. Flash forward to Marilyn Monroe at the Madison Square Garden singing "Happy Birthday, Mr. President." Same thing. She's either drunk, she's ditzy, she's slurring. Both women had gotten shots, heavy shots, immediately before they had to appear on camera, because Jackie Kennedy did not want to do the White House tour on television until she got her shot of meth.
Wow. You mentioned in passing the White House doctor, this physician who starts getting really suspicious and wondering, hey, she contacts Max Jacobson, what the heck are you doing, right?
Yeah, and she said, "Give me some of the drug." And he says, "No. You know, I will give you a shot, so you can know what it feels like, but no, it's my formula and you can't have it." And she mistrusted him, he mistrusted her, and every single doctor that Kennedy then had, there was this admiral who was actually attending the Parkland Hospital autopsy of Kennedy, they all said, "Get rid of this guy Jacobson, he's a danger."
But yet Kennedy always put him above the rest of the doctors and trusted him or kept him close, and the other guy's advice got ignored.
That's the model of addiction. You're exactly right. Kennedy elevated Jacobson to almost divine status within his inner circle at the White House. He never went too far from Jacobson, and the other doctors who knew what Kennedy was getting, who knew the dangers of that drug, they said, get rid of this guy. In fact, one person who told us about the dangers of this drug, actually not us, but C. David Heyman, who turned over those notes, was John F. Kennedy Jr. John F. Kennedy Jr. told David Heyman that his mother, Jackie's death from lymphoma, was one of the results of taking shots from Max Jacobson.
And Robert Kennedy was suspicious.
Robert Kennedy threw them out of the White House. He said, you guys get out of here, go back to New York with the rest of you. I don't want you treating my brother. And he confronts his brother about it and says to his brother, do you know what this stuff is? See, that's how Kennedy found out that it was methamphetamines. He shows him this stuff. And Kennedy says, I don't care if it's horse piss, it makes me feel good. And that was the end of Bobby Kennedy's intervention in stopping Jacobson from giving his brother drugs. But remember, this was only... I mean, only. This was still a three-year run from fall 1960 to the time that Kennedy was assassinated in November 1963.
The most dramatic moment where this drug plays a role is the summit meeting with Khrushchev. Tell that story.
Well, Kennedy ordered Jacobson and his wife Nina to fly with him to Vienna for the summit. But he didn't want the press to know. The press was suspicious. Who was the strange-looking guy with the thick black glasses, with the black curly hair, who always looked disheveled? Who was this guy following the president around? He had this black satchel. Is he a doctor? What kind of a doctor? Press was getting very, very suspicious about this. So Kennedy booked Jacobson on an Air France flight, on a commercial flight to Europe. And then he actually flew on Air Force One to Vienna. There, he's in a kind of an anteroom waiting for Kennedy. He gives Kennedy his shot and says, now I'm giving you a lot, Mr. President, so you have to be careful. I don't want to overdose you. They expected Khrushchev momentarily. What happened was that Khrushchev was late. He kept on delaying it. Now, an interesting thing is that the week before Jacobson left for the summit, his office was broken into, and all his medical records were rifled through. And the question is, who did it? Was it the CIA? Was it the FBI? Was it the KGB? He didn't know. He expected it was the KGB. So they had all the records. Khrushchev knew that he had a man in the Kennedy entourage who was giving Kennedy methamphetamines. After all, Jacobson had been turned by the Soviets in the 1930s. So Khrushchev holds that he doesn't show up. He's late and late and late. Kennedy begins to get down, right? The drug is wearing off. He needs more drugs. He's begging Jacobson for another injection. He gives him one. Finally, by the time Khrushchev shows up, Kennedy had been overdosed. His speech is slurring. He's stumbling around. He can't focus. Khrushchev is laughing, thinking this guy's a pushover. I'm going to roll this guy right over. And it's because of that meeting in Vienna when Khrushchev says to Kennedy, if you don't get out of Berlin, if you don't leave, I'm going to close Berlin down, period. And, of course, the Berlin Wall went up in 1962. But that's what he threatens. He threatens a war. And Kennedy leaves that Vienna meeting. He was completely drugged out, totally strung out. He tells James Reston of the New York Times that was the worst day of his life. And sure enough, shortly thereafter, the Cuban Missile Crisis begins because Khrushchev believes he has a hand to play. He can force Kennedy to accept guided missiles in Cuba. The backstory of all this, and we believe that's a direct result of Jacobson's injections of methamphetamines into Kennedy because Khrushchev thought he was a pushover. But one of the things we found out, actually it was Dick Morris who told us, that the Soviets in 1961 did not have guided missiles capable of reaching the United States. They had no ICBMs. They had intermediate-range ballistic missiles. They could cover Europe, but they couldn't reach the United States. Khrushchev never told the communist leadership and the people in the Supreme Soviet that they didn't have intercontinental ballistic missiles, only IRBMs. That whole story, this is an example of how Khrushchev overplayed his hand at that Vienna summit and with the Cuban Missile Crisis, because when Khrushchev was forced to stand down, to turn his ships away after we blockaded Cuba, it was only then that he told the powers that be in the Soviet Union they never had guided missiles that could reach the United States. And that was the beginning of Khrushchev's downfall. So in an interesting way, again, it wasn't only Kennedy that was affected by it. Khrushchev's career was affected by it as well.
My gosh. And then, of course, the story spreads to Marilyn Monroe. I thought that was one of the most interesting chapters in the book because it also delves into topics near and dear to our heart, Bill, about UFOs and secret bases, things of that sort. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll get into that. Also, Elvis, and then the career of Mickey Mantle, one of the all-time greatest baseball players. You know, he comes into contact with this doctor right at the peak, at a key point of his career. And, heck, there's a really long list of other folks that that you talk to and who are on the list of clients of this doctor that it's pretty much amazing. We'll also touch on UFO Hunters, the other new book that you got out, and open up the phone lines with questions from our listeners. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.
Now, how long have I been preaching to you people out there? I told you about Hitler's use of these drugs, and you can trace all these leaders to every really bad mistake they made, and you can tie it to drugs. Yeah, the right-wing National Socialists gave me all kinds of hell because I said that most of Hitler's blunders, including the invasion of Russia, he was on meth. And I know a lot of people don't want to believe that, but you can see by this story, and this book's available, this Jew, this seedy little Jew from Berlin, Max Jacobson, was behind it all. And there was another Jew, of course, behind the fall of Germany, a man called Lucy. I forget what his name was right now, but I can dig it out for you. He was passing on every secret that the Berlin had during World War II. And the only way that they could, the Russians could keep it quiet, that they knew about it, was to allow the Germans to win a battle once in a while. So anyhow, I tell you, you got to use logic and evidence. And wherever the evidence leads you, you have to accept it no matter how horrible it seems. Otherwise, you're going to be like these great white hope followers out there. They fall in love with these leaders. Oh, they're wonderful. He's going to lead us out of this. Oh, he's going to do it for us. Bullshit. I'll see you tomorrow.
Are you an assassin? I'm a soldier. You're neither. You're an errand boy. Sent by grocery clerks to collect the bill.